So we're really lucky to have Kim Weiner here. I'm going to say a little more about him in a minute. We have a lot of book events here at the Brennan Center. We've had Clarence Jones, who was Martin Luther King's speechwriter and counsel. Albie Sachs, who was had his arm and his eye blown up by the apartheid regime and then became a judge in the South African Constitutional Court. Charles Freed and his son Greg, who spoke about torture, which Charles has had a complete swing in his view in the last 3 or 4 years. Bart Gellman, who did something sort of unusual, Tim, he played for us in talking about his work 2 tapes of people he'd interviewed. And man, they were revealing. The pauses and so forth were really, really, really fantastic. Well, we're here at the Brennan Center, and the Brennan Center is a nonpartisan advocacy group that focuses on democracy and liberty and national security and justice issues and tries to be aggressive using litigation and using reports. And we've begun to make an impact, and it's filled with wonderful people who work here all the time. We're associated with the NYU Law School, which is a great benefit to us, and I hope to them also. Jim Weiner has written 4 books. I'm going to just mention 2 others in addition to Enemies. He wrote a book called Blank Check, which was about secret appropriations, particularly in the Pentagon. That was the part I didn't know about, and also secret appropriations for the intelligence field. He wrote Legacy of Ashes, which got many prizes, the book for about the CIA, history of the CIA. And just now he's written Enemies, a history of the FBI, and it is a comprehensive history of the FBI. Of course, J. Edgar Hoover is important, but he's not the only figure in the book. Tim was a New York Times reporter for a long time. He covered national security issues. I think you lived in Mexico for a couple of years also. He now tells me he's just writing books, but maybe he'll go back to being a journalist too sometime. I want to, before talking a little more about the book, read the dedication in this book, which I thought was the single best dedication I've ever seen in any book. And it says, it's got a poetry to it also, for Robert D. Loomis, who taught me to write, for Professor Dora B. Weiner, who taught me to read, and I knew her actually in connection with Harvard, and then for Kate, Ruby, and Emma Doyle, who teach me to live. That's really pretty damn good. The Kate in there is Kate Doyle, who has been a hero at the National Security Archive in uncovering documents and telling the story of secrets in South America, Central America, and many other places. So the book on the FBI is just a masterful work. It covers a long, long period of time, and it certainly exposes many flaws. It also shows, paradoxically, how at times the Bureau has been doing good and important work instead of dangerous and subversive and undermining American democracy work. So it's a fair book in that sense. And so we're privileged to have a chance to listen to Tim and have him talk for a while and then have a dialogue in which everybody can jump in and ask questions. So, Tim, it's for you.
It's extremely serendipitous that we meet on the eve of the 40th anniversary of the Watergate break.
Yes.
an apocalyptic event in Fritz's life, because the fallout of that is that he went to work undermining the government of the United States. The brains of the church committee. Couple years after. But it's also the 40th anniversary of a decision that was made by the Supreme Court, if not on the day of the Watergate break-in, 24 hours before, and was handed down the following Monday, which you all know is the Keith case, U.S. v. U.S. District Court, which is the first decision that actually outlawed what the FBI had been doing for the last 60 years, which was breaking into people's houses, bugging their apartments and their bedrooms and their offices, and wiretap. The arc of this book is long, as Britt said. It's 103 years. The FBAB was founded in 1908 by Teddy Roosevelt. But the underlying problem, and this is the page after the dedication, in case you're reading along, one of the legs on which the book stands was carved by Alexander Hamilton, who, as you know, was probably the most conservative of the great framers of the Constitution. And Hamilton wrote in the Federalist Number 8, in 1787, pretty much everything you need to know about the tug of war between national security and civil liberties, that is the theme of this book. And Hamilton wrote, and I quote, "Safety from external danger is the most powerful director of national conduct. Even the ardent love of liberty will, after a time, give way to its dictates. The violent destruction of life and property incident to war, the continual effort and alarm attendant on a state of continual danger, will compel nations most attached to liberty to resort for repose and security to institutions which have a tendency to destroy their civil and political rights. To be more safe, they at length become willing to run the risk of being less free." It's Alexander Hamilton, 1787. Yeah, it's incredible, right? One of the other props or frameworks of the book is a comment that Francis Drexel Biddle, one of FDR's more witty attorneys general, we have more than a few, wrote in his memoir. He said, "Every president of war is no great respecter of the Constitution." And I'm speaking of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Mark Twain wrote of, what was it, his fifth cousin, Teddy Roosevelt. He was ready to kick the Constitution in the gutter anytime it pleased him. And it was Teddy Roosevelt who set up the FBI. And he had a couple of reasons for doing it. He did it behind Congress's back, a procedure that Fritz is very familiar with from his days in Washington. And he did it in secret. Now, why did he do it? Why did he set up the FBI, Teddy Roosevelt? Back in 1908. Well, as you history students or majors might remember, Teddy Roosevelt became president at the age of 42, younger than JFK, after an anarchist assassinated the president, William McKinley. Anarchists had been assassinating kings and dukes and princes and earls and queens all over Europe at the end of the 19th century, but they never assassinated the President of the United States. And Teddy wanted to extend the power of the presidency. I mean, he was willing to do anything to preserve and extend and increase his power. I mean, this is the guy that carved the Panama Canal without asking the Panamanians. This is the guy who sent, you know, the U.S. Navy on a global tour of the world just to show that we were a world power. He set up the FBI in a brilliant scheme along with his attorney general, whose name was Charles Joseph Bonaparte. And yes, he was a great nephew of the Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte, to do three things. To extend the rule of federal law across the United States. Remember, in 1908, there weren't even 48 states. There was no radio, there were no national means of communications, there obviously was no television, and the rule of law was quite thin as Washington projected its power across the United States. There was no federal income tax, there was no structure of law, really, no rule of law, federal law across the United States. So he wanted to create a federal network of law. He wanted to control what he called the great malefactors of Wall Street. I mean, the trusts of Wall Street had a greater net worth than the United States government at that time. And the third thing he wanted to do was to crush anarchy. Well, two out of three, bad. He never did get after Wall Street, the FBI never has either. But this never took shape until World War I. And it was Woodrow Wilson that gave it shape. It was Woodrow Wilson who gave it shape through passage which he ran through Congress, a willing and compliant Congress, of the 1917 Espionage Act, which the current administration is using to prosecute and jail leakers and maybe journalists who reveal notional secrets that are not really secrets that are embarrassing the government. Anyway, the 1917 Espionage Act basically made it a crime to speak, utter, write, or publish anything against the foreign policies or the government of the United States. We were at war. The passage of the Espionage Act followed by approximately 18 hours on entry into war. And as Fretzel Biddle said, every president of war, starting with Wilson, believes that he is not just the Commander-in-Chief of the Army and the Navy, as the Constitution says, but Commander-in-Chief of the United States, that his word is law. The Bureau, it was a small, weak, ineffective, and often corrupt force, but it was shortly after American troops landed in France in the summer of 1917 that a 22-year-old fellow from Washington, D.C. named J. Edgar Hoover joined the Justice Department. 3 years later, in 1920, he was running the biggest counterterrorism operation that had ever been mounted in the United States. It had gone down in history as the Palmer Raids after Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, but they were in fact the Hoover Raids. It was Hoover, at the age of 25, who organized a national dragnet that swept in, we'll never know the true number, somewhere between 6 and 10,000 people because of things they had said or thought or written against the United States. It was Hoover who had organized 3 months prior to that, on Labor Day 1919, the infiltration with four government spies who were English speakers and one who was a Russian speaker of the foundation of the Communist Party of the United States, formed in Chicago, Labor Day weekend, 1919. He was president of the creation of the American Communism. The reason he organized these raids, and again, this man was 25 years old. He had a night school undergraduate law degree from George Washington University. He was a very provincial man, born in 1895, never been outside of Washington, D.C. But he saw, in his mind's eye, that Soviet communism was going to rise up from St. Petersburg and Moscow, Vladivostok, and from the killing fields and the trenches of the dead of World War I, and float up like the Spanish influenza that went around the world after World War I and killed tens of millions of people, and float like a toxic cloud over the Atlantic and kill American democracy. That is literally how Hoover saw Soviet communism as a virus. He wrote this in 1920. And that was no metaphor to him. He thought that American democracy would be killed by this foreign ideology that would replicate itself among what passed for the American left. World War I. And so using the Espionage Act as a legal basis, Hoover organized these raids through probably close to 10,000 people in prison, much like the raids after 9/11, through thousands of people whose crime was to look funny, talk funny, or think funny. And the great thing was, and this is the marvelous thing about American democracy and our Constitution and our Bill of Rights, is that this is a tug of war between national security, which is an ideal, we need to protect and defend this country, and civil liberties, which is an ideal too. Liberty and security, as Hamilton said, are opposing forces interwar with one another, but we need to be both safe and free. You have to have hope, security, and liberty.